since almost all of them made several serious mistakes. But since any one of those mistakes is enough to doom your company, it's worth reviewing CleanTech's losing scorecard in more detail. The engineering question. A great technology company should have proprietary technology an order of magnitude better than its nearest substitute. But CleanTech companies rarely produced 2x, let alone 10x improvements. Sometimes their offerings were actually worse than the products they sought to replace. Solyndra developed novel, cylindrical solar cells, but to a first approximation, cylindrical cells are only 1 over pi as efficient as flat ones. They simply don't receive as much direct sunlight. The company tried to correct for this deficiency by using mirrors to reflect more sunlight to hit the bottoms of the panels, but it's hard to recover from a radically inferior starting point. Companies must strive for 10x better because merely incremental improvements often end up meaning no improvement at all for the end user. Suppose you develop a new wind turbine that's 20% more efficient than any existing technology when you test it in the laboratory. That sounds good at first, but the lab result won't begin to compensate for the expenses and risks faced by any new product in the real world. And even if your system really is 20% better on net for the customer who buys it, people are so used to exaggerated claims that you'll be met with skepticism when you try to sell it. Only when your product is 10x better can you offer the customer transparent superiority. The timing question. CleanTech entrepreneurs worked hard to convince themselves that their appointed hour had arrived. When he announced his new company in 2008, SpectraWatt CEO Andrew Wilson stated that the solar industry is akin to where the microprocessor industry was in the late 1970s. There's a lot to be figured out and improved. The second part was right, but the microprocessor analogy was way off. Ever since the first microprocessor was built in 1970, computing advanced not just rapidly, but exponentially. Look at Intel's early product release history. They released a 4-bit chip in 1971. The next year, they released an 8-bit chip. By 1978, Intel had a 16-bit chip. And by 1981, they released a 32-bit chip. The first silicon solar cell, by contrast, was created by Bell Labs in 1954, more than a half century before Wilson's press release. Photovoltaic efficiency improved in the intervening decades, but slowly and linearly. Bell's first solar cell had about 6% efficiency. Neither today's crystalline silicon cells nor modern thin film cells have exceeded 25% efficiency in the field. There were few engineering developments in the mid-2000s to suggest impending liftoff. Entering a slow-moving market can be a good strategy, but only if you have a definite and realistic plan to take it over. The failed CleanTech companies had none. The monopoly question. In 2006, billionaire technology investor John Doerr announced that green is the new red, white, and blue. He could have stopped at red. As Doerr himself said, internet-sized markets are in the billions of dollars. The energy markets are in the trillions. What he didn't say is that huge, trillion-dollar markets mean ruthless, bloody competition. Others echoed Doerr over and over. In the 2000s, I listened to dozens of CleanTech entrepreneurs begin fantastically rosy PowerPoint presentations with all too true tales of trillion-dollar markets, as if that were a good thing. CleanTech executives emphasized the bounty of an energy market big enough for all comers, but each one typically believed that his own company had an edge. In 2006, Dave Pierce, CEO of solar manufacturer Mia Soleil, admitted to a congressional panel that his company was just one of several very strong startups working on one particular kind of thin-film solar cell development. Minutes later, Pierce predicted that Mia Soleil would become the largest producer of thin-film solar cells in the world within a year's time. That didn't happen, but it might not have helped him anyway. Thin-film is just one of more than a dozen kinds of solar cells. Customers won't care about any particular technology unless it solves a particular problem in a superior way. And if you can't monopolize a unique solution for a small market, you'll be stuck with vicious competition. That's what happened to Mia Soleil, which was acquired in 2013 for hundreds of millions of dollars less than its investors had put into the company. Exaggerating your own uniqueness is an easy way to botch the monopoly question. Suppose you're running a solar company that's successfully installed hundreds of solar panel systems with a combined power generation capacity of 100 megawatts. Since total U.S. solar energy production capacity is 950 megawatts, you own 10.53% of the market. Congratulations, you tell yourself. You're a player. But what if the U.S. solar energy market isn't the relevant market? What if the relevant market is the global solar market, with a production capacity of 18 gigawatts? Your 100 megawatts now makes you a very small fish indeed. Suddenly, you own less than 1% of the market. And what if the appropriate measure isn't global solar, but rather renewable energy in general? Annual production capacity from renewables is 420 gigawatts globally. You just shrank to 0.02% of the market. And compared to the total global power generation capacity of 15,000 gigawatts, your 100 megawatts is just a drop in the ocean. Cleantech entrepreneurs thinking about markets was hopelessly confused. They would rhetorically shrink their market in order to seem differentiated, only to turn around and ask to be valued based on huge, supposedly lucrative markets. But you can't dominate a submarket if it's fictional, and huge markets are highly competitive, not highly attainable. Most cleantech founders would have been better off opening a new British restaurant in downtown Palo Alto. The people question. Energy problems are engineering problems, so you would expect to find nerds running cleantech companies. You'd be wrong. The ones that failed were run by shockingly non-technical teams. These salesman executives were good at raising capital and securing government subsidies, but they were less good at building products that customers wanted to buy. At Founders Fund, we saw this coming. The most obvious clue was sartorial. Cleantech executives were running around wearing suits and ties. This was a huge red flag, because real technologists wear t-shirts and jeans. So we instituted a blanket rule. Pass on any company whose founders dressed up for pitch meetings. Maybe we still would have avoided the bad investments if we had taken the time to evaluate each company's technology in detail. But the team insight, never invest in a tech CEO that wears a suit, got us to the truth a lot faster. The best sales is hidden. There's nothing wrong with the CEO who can sell, but if he actually looks like a salesman, he's probably bad at sales and worse at tech. The distribution question. Cleantech companies effectively courted government and investors, but they often forgot about customers. They learned the hard way that the world is not a laboratory. Selling and delivering a product is at least as important as the product itself. Just ask Israeli electric vehicle startup Better Place, which from 2007 to 2012 raised and spent more than $800 million to build swappable battery packs and charging stations for electric cars. The company sought to create a green alternative that would lessen our dependence on highly polluting transportation technologies. And it did just that, at least by 1,000 cars, the number it sold before filing for bankruptcy. Even selling that many was an achievement, because each of those cars was very hard for customers to buy. For starters, it was never clear what you were actually buying. Better Place bought sedans from Renault and refitted them with electric batteries and electric motors. So, were you buying an electric Renault, or were you buying a Better Place? In any case, if you decided to buy one, you had to jump through a series of hoops. First, you needed to seek approval from Better Place. To get that, you had to prove that you lived close enough to a Better Place battery swapping station and promised to follow predictable routes. If you passed that test, you had to sign up for a fueling subscription in order to recharge your car. Only then could you get started learning the new behavior of stopping to swap out battery packs on the road. Better Place thought its technology spoke for itself, so they didn't bother to market it clearly. Reflecting on the company's failure, one frustrated customer asked, "Why wasn't there a billboard in Tel Aviv showing a picture of a Toyota Prius for 160,000 shekels and a picture of this car for 160,000 plus fuel for 4 years?" He still bought one of the cars, but unlike most people, he was a hobbyist who would do anything to keep driving it. Unfortunately, he can't. As the Better Place board of directors stated upon selling the company's assets for a meager $12 million in 2013, "The technical challenges we overcame successfully, but the other obstacles we were not able to overcome." The durability question. Every entrepreneur should plan to be the last mover in her particular market. That starts with asking yourself, what will the world look like 10 and 20 years from now, and how will my business fit in? Few clean tech companies had a good answer. As a result, all their obituaries resemble each other. A few months before it filed for bankruptcy in 2011, Evergreen Solar explained its decision to close one of its U.S. factories. "Solar manufacturers in China have received considerable government and financial support. Although our production costs are now below originally planned levels and lower than most Western manufacturers, they're still much higher than those of our low-cost competitors in China." But it wasn't until 2012 that the "Blame China" chorus really exploded. Discussing its bankruptcy filing, U.S. Department of Energy-backed Abound Solar blamed aggressive pricing actions from Chinese solar panel companies that made it very difficult for an early-stage startup company to scale in current market conditions. When solar panel maker Energy Conversion Devices failed in February 2012, it went beyond blaming China in a press release and filed a $950 million lawsuit against three prominent Chinese solar manufacturers. The same companies that Solyndra's trustees in bankruptcy sued later that year on the grounds of attempted monopolization, conspiracy, and predatory pricing. But was competition from Chinese manufacturers really impossible to predict? Clean tech entrepreneurs would have done well to rephrase the durability question and ask, what will stop China from wiping out my business? Without an answer, the result shouldn't have come as a surprise. Beyond the failure to anticipate competition in manufacturing the same green products, cleantech embraced misguided assumptions about the energy market as a whole. An industry premised on the supposed twilight of fossil fuels was blindsided by the rise of fracking. In 2000, just 1.7% of America's natural gas came from fracked shale. 5 years later, that figure had climbed to 4.1%. Nevertheless, nobody in cleantech took this trend seriously. Renewables were the only way forward. Fossil fuels couldn't possibly get cheaper or cleaner in the future. But they did. By 2013, shale gas accounted for 34% of America's natural gas, and gas prices had fallen more than 70% since 2008, devastating most renewable energy business models. Fracking may not be a durable energy solution either, but it was enough to doom clean tech companies that didn't see it coming. The secret question. Every clean tech company justified itself with conventional truths about the need for a cleaner world. They deluded themselves into believing that an overwhelming social need for alternative energy solutions implied an overwhelming business opportunity for clean tech companies of all kinds. Consider how conventional it had become by 2006 to be bullish on solar. That year, President George W. Bush heralded a future of solar roofs that will enable the American family to be able to generate their own electricity. Investor and cleantech executive Bill Gross declared that the potential for solar is enormous. Suvi Sharma, then CEO of solar manufacturer Solaria, admitted that while there is a gold rush feeling to solar, there's also real gold here. Or, in our case, sunshine. But rushing to embrace the convention sent scores of solar panel companies, Q-Cells, Evergreen Solar, SpectraWatt, and even Gross's own energy innovations, to name just a few, from promising beginnings to bankruptcy court very quickly. Each of the casualties had described their bright futures using broad conventions on which everybody agreed. Great companies have secrets, specific reasons for success that other people don't see. The myth of social entrepreneurship. Cleantech entrepreneurs aimed for more than just success, as most businesses define it. The cleantech bubble was the biggest phenomenon, and the biggest flop, in the history of social entrepreneurship. This philanthropic approach to business starts with the idea that corporations and nonprofits have until now been polar opposites. Corporations have great power, but they're shackled to the profit motive. Nonprofits pursue the public interest, but they're weak players in the wider economy. Social entrepreneurs aim to combine the best of both worlds and do well by doing good. Usually, they end up doing neither. The ambiguity between social and financial goals doesn't help. But the ambiguity in the word social is even more of a problem. If something is socially good, is it good for society or merely seen as good by society? Whatever is good enough to receive applause from all audiences can only be conventional, like the general idea of green energy. Progress isn't held back by some difference between corporate greed and nonprofit goodness. Instead, we're held back by the sameness of both. Just as corporations tend to copy each other, nonprofits all tend to push the same priorities. Cleantech shows the result. Hundreds of undifferentiated products, all in the name of one overbroad goal. Doing something different is what's truly good for society, and it's also what allows a business to profit by monopolizing a new market. The best projects are likely to be overlooked, not trumpeted by a crowd. The best problems to work on are often the ones nobody else even tries to solve. Tesla. 7 for 7. Tesla is one of the few cleantech companies started last decade to be thriving today. They rode the social buzz of cleantech better than anyone, but they got the 7 questions right, so their success is instructive. 1. Technology. Tesla's technology is so good that other car companies rely on it. Daimler uses Tesla's battery packs. Mercedes-Benz uses a Tesla powertrain. Toyota uses a Tesla motor. General Motors has even created a task force to track Tesla's next moves. But Tesla's greatest technological achievement isn't any single part or component, but rather its ability to integrate many components into one superior product. The Tesla Model S sedan, elegantly designed from end to end, is more than the sum of its parts. Consumer Reports rated it higher than any other car ever reviewed, and both Motor Trend and Automobile magazines named it their 2013 Car of the Year. 2. Timing. In 2009, it was easy to think that the government would continue to support cleantech. Green jobs were a political priority, federal funds were already earmarked, and Congress even seemed likely to pass cap-and-trade legislation. But where others saw generous subsidies that could flow indefinitely, Tesla CEO Elon Musk rightly saw a one-time-only opportunity. In January 2010, about a year and a half before Solyndra imploded under the Obama administration and politicized the subsidy question, Tesla secured a $465 million loan from the U.S. Department of Energy. A $500 million subsidy was unthinkable in the mid-2000s. It's unthinkable today. There was only one moment where that was possible, and Tesla played it perfectly. 3. Monopoly. Tesla started with a tiny submarket that it could dominate, the market for high-end electric sports cars. Since the first Roadster rolled off the production line in 2008, Tesla sold only about 3,000 of them. But at $109,000 a piece, that's not trivial. Starting small allowed Tesla to undertake the necessary R&D to build the slightly less expensive Model S, and now Tesla owns the luxury electric sedan market too. They sold more than 20,000 sedans in 2013, and now Tesla is in prime position to expand to broader markets in the future. 4. Team. Tesla's CEO is the consummate engineer and salesman, so it's not surprising that he's assembled a team that's very good at both. Elon describes his staff this way. If you're at Tesla, you're choosing to be at the equivalent of special forces. There's the regular army, and that's fine, but if you're working at Tesla, you're choosing to step up your game. 5. Distribution. Most companies underestimate distribution, but Tesla took it so seriously that it decided to own the entire distribution chain. Other car companies are beholden to independent dealerships. Ford and Hyundai make cars, but they rely on other people to sell them. Tesla sells and services its vehicles in its own stores. The upfront costs of Tesla's approach are much higher than traditional dealership distribution, but it affords control over the customer experience, strengthens Tesla's brand, and saves the company money in the long run. 6. Durability. Tesla has a head start and it's moving faster than anyone else. And that combination means its lead is set to widen in the years ahead. A coveted brand is the clearest sign of Tesla's breakthrough. A car is one of the biggest purchasing decisions that people ever make, and consumers' trust in that category is hard to win. And unlike every other car company, at Tesla, the founder is still in charge, so it's not going to ease off anytime soon. 7. Secrets. Tesla knew that fashion drove interest in clean tech. Rich people especially wanted to appear green, even if it meant driving a boxy Prius or a clunky Honda Insight. Those cars only made drivers look cool by association with the famous eco-conscious movie stars who owned them as well. So Tesla decided to build cars that made drivers look cool, period. Leonardo DiCaprio even ditched his Prius for an expensive and expensive-looking Tesla Roadster. While generic clean tech companies struggled to differentiate themselves, Tesla built a unique brand around the secret that clean tech was even more of a social phenomenon than an environmental imperative. Energy 2.0. Tesla's success proves that there was nothing inherently wrong with clean tech. The biggest idea behind it is right. The world really will need new sources of energy. Energy is the master resource. It's how we feed ourselves, build shelter, and make everything we need to live comfortably. Most of the world dreams of living as comfortably as Americans do today, and globalization will cause increasingly severe energy challenges unless we build new technology. There simply aren't enough resources in the world to replicate old approaches or redistribute our way to prosperity. Clean tech gave people a way to be optimistic about the future of energy. But when indefinitely optimistic investors betting on the general idea of green energy funded clean tech companies that lacked specific business plans, the result was a bubble. Plot the valuation of alternative energy firms in the 2000s alongside the Nasdaq's rise and fall a decade before, and you see the same shape. The 1990s had one big idea. The internet is going to be big. But too many internet companies had exactly that same idea, and no others. An entrepreneur can't benefit from macro-scale insight unless his own plans begin at the micro-scale. Clean tech companies faced the same problem. No matter how much the world needs energy, only a firm that offers a superior solution for a specific energy problem can make money. No sector will ever be so important that merely participating in it will be enough to build a great company. The tech bubble was far bigger than clean tech, and the crash even more painful. But the dream of the 90s turned out to be right. Skeptics who doubted that the internet would fundamentally change publishing or retail sales or everyday social life looked prescient in 2001, but they seem comically foolish today. Could successful energy startups be founded after the clean tech crash, just as Web 2.0 startups successfully launched amid the debris of the dot-coms? The macro need for energy solutions is still real, but a valuable business must start by finding a niche and dominating a small market. Facebook started as a service for just one university campus before it spread to other schools and then the entire world. Finding small markets for energy solutions will be tricky. You could aim to replace diesel as a power source for remote islands, or maybe build modular reactors for quick deployment at military installations in hostile territories. Paradoxically, the challenge for the entrepreneurs who will create Energy 2.0 is to think small. Chapter 14. The Founder's Paradox. Of the six people who started PayPal, four had built bombs in high school. Five were just 23 years old, or younger. Four of us had been born outside the United States. Three had escaped here from communist countries. Yu Pan from China, Luke Nozick from Poland, and Max Levchin from Soviet Ukraine. Building bombs was not what kids normally did in those countries at that time. The six of us could have been seen as eccentric. My first ever conversation with Luke was about how he'd just signed up for cryonics to be frozen upon death in hope of medical resurrection. Max claimed to be without a country and proud of it. His family was put into diplomatic limbo when the USSR collapsed while they were escaping to the US. Russ Simmons had escaped from a trailer park to the top math and science magnet school in Illinois. Only Ken Howery fit the stereotype of a privileged American childhood. He was PayPal's sole Eagle Scout. But Kenny's peers thought he was crazy to join the rest of us and make just one-third of the salary he'd been offered by a big bank. So even he wasn't entirely normal. Are all founders unusual people? Or do we just tend to remember and exaggerate whatever is most unusual about them? More important, which personal traits actually matter in a founder? This chapter is about why it's more powerful but at the same time more dangerous for a company to be led by a distinctive individual instead of an interchangeable manager. The difference engine. Some people are strong, some are weak, some are geniuses, some are dullards, but most people are in the middle. Plot where everyone falls and you'll see a bell curve. Since so many founders seem to have extreme traits, you might guess that a plot showing only founders' traits would have fatter tails, with more people at either end. But that doesn't capture the strangest thing about founders. Normally, we expect opposite traits to be mutually exclusive. A normal person can't be both rich and poor at the same time, for instance. But it happens all the time to founders. Startup CEOs can be cash poor, but millionaires on paper. They may oscillate between sullen jerkiness and appealing charisma. Almost all successful entrepreneurs are simultaneously insiders and outsiders. And when they do succeed, they attract both fame and infamy. When you plot them out, founders' traits appear to follow an inverse normal distribution. Where does this strange and extreme combination of traits come from? They could be present from birth, nature, or acquired from an individual's environment, nurture. But perhaps founders aren't really as extreme as they appear. Might they strategically exaggerate certain qualities? Or is it possible that everyone else exaggerates them? All of these effects can be present at the same time, and whenever present, they powerfully reinforce each other. The cycle usually starts with unusual people and ends with them acting and seeming even more unusual. As an example, take Sir Richard Branson, the billionaire founder of the Virgin Group. He could be described as a natural entrepreneur. Branson started his first business at age 16, and at just 22, he founded Virgin Records. But other aspects of his renown, the trademark lion's mane hairstyle, for example, are less natural. One suspects he wasn't born with that exact look. As Branson has cultivated his other extreme traits, is kiteboarding with naked supermodels a PR stunt? Just a guy having fun? Both? The media has eagerly enthroned him. Branson is the Virgin King, the undisputed king of PR, the king of branding, and the king of the desert and space. when Virgin Atlantic Airways began serving passengers drinks with ice cubes shaped like Branson's face, he became the Ice King. Is Branson just a normal businessman who happens to be lionized by the media with the help of a good PR team? Or is he himself a born branding genius, rightly singled out by the journalists he is so good at manipulating? It's hard to tell. Maybe he's both. Another example is Sean Parker, who started out with the ultimate outsider status, criminal. Sean was a careful hacker in high school. But his father decided that Sean was spending too much time on the computer for a 16-year-old, so one day he took away Sean's keyboard mid-hack. Sean couldn't log out. The FBI noticed. Soon, federal agents were placing him under arrest. Sean got off easy since he was a minor. If anything, the episode emboldened him. 3 years later, he co-founded Napster. The peer-to-peer file-sharing service amassed 10 million users in its first year, making it one of the fastest-growing businesses of all time. But the record companies sued, and a federal judge ordered it shut down 20 months after opening. After a whirlwind period at the center, Sean was back to being an outsider again. Then came Facebook. Sean met Mark Zuckerberg in 2004, helped negotiate Facebook's first funding, and became the company's founding president. He had to step down in 2005 amid allegations of drug use, but this only enhanced his notoriety. Ever since Justin Timberlake portrayed him in the movie The Social Network, Sean has been perceived as one of the coolest people in America. JT is still more famous, but when he visits Silicon Valley, people ask him if he's Sean Parker. The most famous people in the world are founders too. Instead of a company, every celebrity founds and cultivates a personal brand. Lady Gaga, for example, became one of the most influential living people. But is she even a real person? Her real name isn't a secret, but almost no one knows or cares what it is. She wears costumes so bizarre as to put any other wearer at risk of an involuntary psychiatric hold. Gaga would have you believe that she was born this way, the title of both her second album and its lead track. But no one is born looking like a zombie with horns coming out of her head. Gaga must therefore be a self-manufactured myth. Then again, what kind of person would do this to herself? Certainly nobody normal. So perhaps Gaga really was born that way. Where kings come from. Extreme founder figures are not new in human affairs. Classical mythology is full of them. Oedipus is the paradigmatic insider-outsider. He was abandoned as an infant and ended up in a foreign land, but he was a brilliant king and smart enough to solve the riddle of the Sphinx. Romulus and Remus were born of royal blood and abandoned as orphans. When they discovered their pedigree, they decided to found a city. But they couldn't agree on where to put it. When Remus crossed the boundary that Romulus had decided was the edge of Rome, Romulus killed him, declaring, "So perish everyone that shall hereafter leap over my wall." Lawmaker and lawbreaker, criminal outlaw and king who defined Rome, Romulus was a self-contradictory insider-outsider. Normal people aren't like Oedipus or Romulus. Whatever those individuals were actually like in life, the mythologized versions of them depict only the extremes. But why was it so important for archaic cultures to remember extraordinary people? The famous and infamous have always served as vessels for public sentiment. They're praised amid prosperity and blamed for misfortune. Primitive societies faced one fundamental problem above all. They would be torn apart by conflict if they didn't have a way to stop it. So whenever plagues, disasters, or violent rivalries threatened the peace, it was beneficial for the society to place the entire blame on a single person, someone who everyone could agree on. A scapegoat. Who makes an effective scapegoat? Like founders, scapegoats are extreme and contradictory figures. On the one hand, a scapegoat is necessarily weak. He is powerless to stop his own victimization. On the other hand, as the one who can defuse conflict by taking the blame, he is the most powerful member of the community. Before execution, scapegoats were often worshipped like deities. The Aztecs considered their victims to be earthly forms of the gods to whom they were sacrificed. You'd be dressed in fine clothes and feast royally until your brief reign ended and they cut your heart out. These are the roots of monarchy. Every king was a living god, and every god a murdered king. Perhaps every modern king is just a scapegoat who has managed to delay his own execution. American royalty. Celebrities are supposedly American royalty. We even grant titles to our favorite performers. Elvis Presley was the king of rock. Michael Jackson was the king of pop. Britney Spears was the pop princess. Until they weren't. Elvis self-destructed in the 70s and died alone, overweight, sitting on his toilet. Today, his impersonators are fat and sketchy, not lean and cool. Michael Jackson went from beloved child star to an erratic, physically repulsive, drug-addicted shell of his former self. The world reveled in the details of his trials. Britney's story is the most dramatic of all. We created her from nothing, elevating her to superstardom as a teenager. But then everything fell off the tracks. Witness the shaved head, the over- and under-eating scandals, and the highly publicized court case to take away her children. Was she always a little bit crazy? Did the publicity just get to her? Or did she do it all to get more? For some fallen stars, death brings resurrection. So many popular musicians have died at age 27. Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, and Kurt Cobain, for example, that this set has become immortalized as the 27 Club. Before she joined the club in 2011, Amy Winehouse sang, "They tried to make me go to rehab, but I said, no, no, no." Maybe rehab seemed so unattractive because it blocked the path to immortality. Perhaps the only way to be a rock god forever is to die an early death. We alternately worship and despise technology founders just as we do celebrities. Howard Hughes's arc from fame to pity is the most dramatic of any 20th century tech founder. He was born wealthy, but he was always more interested in engineering than luxury. He built Houston's first radio transmitter at the age of 11. The year after that, he built the city's first motorcycle. By age 30, he'd made 9 commercially successful movies at a time when Hollywood was on the technological frontier. But Hughes was even more famous for his parallel career in aviation. He designed planes, produced them, and piloted them himself. Hughes set world records for top airspeed, fastest transcontinental flight, and fastest flight around the world. Hughes was obsessed with flying higher than everyone else. He liked to remind people that he was a mere mortal, not a Greek god. Something that mortals say only when they want to invite comparisons to gods. Hughes was a man to whom you cannot apply the same standards as you can to you and me, his lawyer once argued in federal court. Hughes paid the lawyer to say that, but according to the New York Times, there was no dispute on this point from judge or jury. When Hughes was awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in 1939 for his achievements in aviation, he didn't even show up to claim it. Years later, President Truman found it in the White House and mailed it to him. The beginning of Hughes's end came in 1946, when he suffered his third and worst plane crash. Had he died then, he would have been remembered forever as one of the most dashing and successful Americans of all time. But he survived. Barely. He became obsessive-compulsive, addicted to painkillers, and withdrew from the public to spend the last 30 years of his life in self-imposed solitary confinement. Hughes had always acted a little crazy, on the theory that fewer people would want to bother a crazy person. But when his crazy act turned into a crazy life, he became an object of pity as much as awe. More recently, Bill Gates has shown how highly visible success can attract highly focused attacks. Gates embodied the founder archetype. He was simultaneously an awkward and nerdy college dropout outsider and the world's wealthiest insider. Did he choose his geeky eyeglasses strategically, to build up a distinctive persona? Or, in his incurable nerdiness, did his geek glasses choose him? It's hard to know. But his dominance was undeniable. Microsoft's Windows claimed a 90% share of the market for operating systems in 2000. That year, Peter Jennings could plausibly ask, "Who is more important in the world today, Bill Clinton or Bill Gates?" I don't know. It's a good question. The U.S. Department of Justice didn't limit itself to rhetorical questions. They opened an investigation and sued Microsoft for anti-competitive conduct. In June 2000, a court ordered that Microsoft be broken apart. Gates had stepped down as CEO of Microsoft 6 months earlier, having been forced to spend most of his time responding to legal threats instead of building new technology. A court of appeals later overturned the breakup order, and Microsoft reached a settlement with the government in 2001. But by then, Gates' enemies had already deprived his company of the full engagement of its founder, and Microsoft entered an era of relative stagnation. Today, Gates is better known as a philanthropist than a technologist. The Return of the King. Just as the legal attack on Microsoft was ending Bill Gates' dominance, Steve Jobs' return to Apple demonstrated the irreplaceable value of a company's founder. In some ways, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were opposites. Jobs was an artist, preferred closed systems, and spent his time thinking about great products above all else. Gates was a businessman, kept his products open, and wanted to run the world. But both were insider-outsiders, and both pushed the companies they started to achievements that nobody else would have been able to match. A college dropout who walked around barefoot and refused to shower, Jobs was also the insider of his own personality cult. He could act charismatic or crazy, perhaps according to his mood, or perhaps according to his calculations. It's hard to believe that such weird practices as Apple-only diets weren't part of a larger strategy. But all this eccentricity backfired on him in 1985. Apple's board effectively kicked Jobs out of his own company when he clashed with the professional CEO brought in to provide adult supervision. Jobs' return to Apple 12 years later shows how the most important task in business, the creation of new value, cannot be reduced to a formula and applied by professionals. When he was hired as interim CEO of Apple in 1997, the impeccably credentialed executives who preceded him had steered the company nearly to bankruptcy. That year, Michael Dell famously said of Apple, "What would I do? I'd shut it down and give the money back to the shareholders." Instead, Jobs introduced the iPod in 2001, the iPhone in 2007, and the iPad in 2010, before he had to resign in 2011 because of poor health. By the following year, Apple was the single most valuable company in the world. Apple's value crucially depended on the singular vision of a particular person. This hints at the strange way in which the companies that create new technology often resemble feudal monarchies rather than organizations that are supposedly more modern. A unique founder can make authoritative decisions, inspire strong personal loyalty, and plan ahead for decades. Paradoxically, impersonal bureaucracies staffed by trained professionals can last longer than any lifetime, but they usually act with short time horizons. The lesson for business is that we need founders. If anything, we should be more tolerant of founders who seem strange or extreme. We need unusual individuals to lead companies beyond mere incrementalism. The lesson for founders is that individual prominence and adulation can never be enjoyed except on the condition that it may be exchanged for individual notoriety and demonization at any moment. So be careful. Above all, don't overestimate your own power as an individual. Founders are important not because they are the only ones whose work has value, but rather because a great founder can bring out the best work from everybody at his company. That we need individual founders in all their peculiarity does not mean that we are called to worship Ayn Randian prime movers, who claim to be independent of everybody around them. In this respect, Rand was a merely half-great writer. Her villains were real, but her heroes were fake. There is no Galt's Gulch. There is no secession from society. To believe yourself invested with divine self-sufficiency is not the mark of a strong individual, but of a person who has mistaken the crowd's worship or jeering for the truth. The single greatest danger for a founder is to become so certain of his own myth that he loses his mind. But an equally insidious danger for every business is to lose all sense of myth and mistake disenchantment for wisdom. Conclusion. Stagnation or singularity. If even the most far-sighted founders cannot plan beyond the next 20 to 30 years, is there anything to say about the very distant future? We don't know anything specific, but we can make out the broad contours. Philosopher Nick Bostrom describes four possible patterns for the future of humanity. The ancients saw all of history as a never-ending alternation between prosperity and ruin. Only recently have people dared to hope that we might permanently escape misfortune, and it's still possible to wonder whether the stability we take for granted will last. However, we usually suppress our doubts. Conventional wisdom seems to assume instead that the whole world will converge toward a plateau of development similar to the life of the richest countries today. In this scenario, the future will look a lot like the present. Given the interconnected geography of the contemporary world and the unprecedented destructive power of modern weaponry, it's hard not to ask whether a large-scale social disaster could be contained were it to occur. This is what fuels our fears of the third possible scenario, a collapse so devastating that we won't survive it. The last of the four possibilities is the hardest one to imagine, accelerating takeoff toward a much better future. The end result of such a breakthrough could take a number of forms, but any one of them would be so different from the present as to defy description. Which of the four will it be? Recurrent collapse seems unlikely. The knowledge underlying civilization is so widespread today that complete annihilation would be more probable than a long period of darkness followed by recovery. However, in case of extinction, there is no human future of any kind to consider. If we define the future as a time that looks different from the present, then most people aren't expecting any future at all. Instead, they expect coming decades to bring more globalization, convergence, and sameness. In this scenario, poorer countries will catch up to richer countries, and the world as a whole will reach an economic plateau. But even if a truly globalized plateau were possible, could it last? In the best case, economic competition would be more intense than ever before for every single person and firm on the planet. However, when you add competition to consume scarce resources, it's hard to see how a global plateau could last indefinitely. Without new technology to relieve competitive pressures, stagnation is likely to erupt into conflict. In case of conflict on a global scale, stagnation collapses into extinction. That leaves the fourth scenario, in which we create new technology to make a much better future. The most dramatic version of this outcome is called the singularity, an attempt to name the imagined result of new technologies so powerful as to transcend the current limits of our understanding. Ray Kurzweil, the best-known singularitarian, starts from Moore's law and traces exponential growth trends in dozens of fields, confidently projecting a future of superhuman artificial intelligence. According to Kurzweil, the singularity is near. It's inevitable, and all we have to do is prepare ourselves to accept it. But no matter how many trends can be traced, the future won't happen on its own. What the singularity would look like matters less than the stark choice we face today between the two most likely scenarios, nothing or something. It's up to us. We cannot take for granted that the future will be better, and that means we need to work to create it today. Whether we achieve the singularity on a cosmic scale is perhaps less important than whether we seize the unique opportunities we have to do new things in our own working lives. Everything important to us, the universe, the planet, the country, your company, your life, and this very moment is singular. Our task today is to find singular ways to create the new things that will make the future not just different, but better. To go from zero to one. The essential first step is to think for yourself. Only by seeing our world anew, as fresh and strange as it was to the ancients who saw it first, can we both recreate it and preserve it for the future. This is Blake Masters. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Zero to One, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future by Peter Thiel with Blake Masters. This program was directed by Jessica Kay, executive producer Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2014 by Peter Thiel. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.